Good morning and welcome to the Daily Digest from Personalized Intelligence. It's Saturday, March 28th, and this is our Macro Geopolitics AI Blockchain Edition, packed as always. I'm Maya.
And I'm Alex. And Maya, honestly, even I'm a little surprised by how quickly things are converging. We're talking about a world where geopolitical fault lines are actively reshaping the global economic landscape, and the potential for recession is no longer a hypothetical.
Right. And speaking of reshaping, let's dive into AI agents. We've been talking about automation, but what happens when these agents start building the future of commerce autonomously? Is this the next evolution of the internet or something entirely different?
Different is the word. Think of the Earth's crust under immense pressure, building silently until a sudden eruption reshapes everything. That's what feels like it's happening in energy markets right now. Infrastructure bottlenecks, the rise of tokenization and predictive models that are, well, let's just say imperfect.
Imperfect is an understatement. We'll unpack the limits of prediction today, Alex. And finally, we're looking at market dynamics and whether anyone can actually see around the corner. You remember last week's call on?
Don't remind me. Let's just say we're approaching the data with a healthy dose of skepticism. Buckle up, it's going to be a fascinating hour.
Natasha Kaneva flagged roughly 16 million barrels per day of oil supply currently sidelined. Let's talk about global macro risks, geopolitics and recessionary pressures, specifically how the US-Iran conflict and the Danish election are twisting the knife on global economic trends. Why are we suddenly obsessing over oil tankers again?
The sidelining of that volume isn't simply a static number. It's creating an anticipated shortfall of around 10 million barrels per day, pushing Brent to $111 and WTI to $98. That price pressure isn't uniform. The conflict is unfolding as a sequential stock depletion problem rather than a simultaneous flow shock, meaning timing, not just volume, is critical. We're seeing initial demand destruction in Southeast Asia, which is a leading indicator of broader regional impacts.
Demand destruction in Southeast Asia. So scooters are going to save us from a geopolitical meltdown. Seriously though, what does this stock depletion pattern actually mean for the rest of the world?
It means the impact radiates outward from Asia westward, based on shipping times 10 to 45 days, according to the Global Commodities Report. This mirrors the COVID-19 disruption pattern, and it's why continuous monitoring of inventory levels and policy responses is essential. The U.S. will be least affected by direct physical shortages, but even will feel it through higher prices and refining runs declining worldwide due to logistical bottlenecks.
Logistical bottlenecks, fancy. So the U.S. is insulated but not immune. How much buffer do we even have? Are those strategic petroleum reserve releases actually moving the needle?
SPR releases of 2.1 million barrels per day and increased flows from Saudi Arabia and the UAE are partially offsetting the shock, but global oil inventories have fallen sharply, almost 10 million barrels in the first 3 weeks of March. That's a concerning trend, exacerbated by uneven distribution. And crucially, Russia and Iran hold 0.5 million barrels per day of floating storage, which is a strategic asset they're not necessarily eager to release.
Russia and Iran holding the cards. That feels suboptimal. The Filipino report suggests Trump was initially issuing 48-hour ultimatums, then extending them. Is this just political theater, or is there actual strategy behind the shifting deadlines?
The pattern of extending ultimatums is losing credibility, and the market is recognizing that. The U.S. has deployed thousands of combat forces, potentially preparing for a ground invasion to secure key locations, and Abigail Hoslerner's reporting indicates Iran currently has limited incentive to negotiate. This shifts agency to Iran, and as the report notes, market direction will increasingly be dictated by Iranian actions and statements, not U.S. policy.
Market direction dictated by Iran. I need a stronger coffee. What's the worst-case scenario here, financially speaking?
Military strike on Karg Island is widely expected to cause a significant spike in oil prices and severely destabilize global energy markets. Beyond that, the dollar hasn't functioned as a safe haven currency during this crisis, indicating a loss of investor confidence. That's a major red flag. The U.S. government's stated objective of maintaining 10-year bond yields around 4% is threatened by higher energy prices, increased defense spending, and green energy investments.
Bond yields at 4% as a target, is that even achievable anymore? The FX report notes that energy importer currencies like the euro and sterling are likely to underperform the longer the conflict persists.
The pattern is clear: the longer the conflict continues, the greater the pressure on those currencies. James Nelligan's analysis suggests a shift towards a high inflation, moderate growth outlook, potentially favoring FX carry strategies, but careful selection is crucial. We're seeing a novel dynamic where commodity exporters are shifting their focus from terms of trade to equity beta.
Equity beta instead of terms of trade. So they're betting on overall market performance, not just commodity prices. That's a significant shift in risk appetite. What does that mean for specific currencies?
It means currencies like Nokia in Australia, with strong domestic fundamentals, are becoming more attractive. Conversely, sterling is facing a potentially toxic mix due to pro-inflationary policies from Angela Rayner and a weakening labor market. The UK is vulnerable, and the report's bearish bias towards the currency is justified.
A toxic mix for sterling. Lovely. The Global FX report also mentioned healthy carry versus unhealthy carry. Can you unpack that?
Healthy carry refers to currencies with strong fundamentals supporting higher yields, think Australia. Unhealthy carry is where the yield is high because of underlying economic weakness and political risks, like sterling. The risk is that political shocks trigger outflows, negating the carry benefit. They backtesting carry strategies under a high inflation, moderate growth environment.
So we're looking at a world where higher yields aren't necessarily a good thing. What about the broader economic picture? The Datapod report predicts a 0.6% reduction in global GDP growth with oil at $100.80.
That's the baseline scenario. But Lupton forecasts a 40 to 45% probability of a recession in the middle quarters of the year, significantly higher than Kasman's assessment. The risk of a parabolic increase in commodity prices is underestimated, particularly if Strait of Hormuz supply remains constrained.
A 40% recession probability. That's not nothing. Kasman believes the economy's current momentum will mitigate the impact. Is he being overly optimistic?
Kasman's view is based on the assumption of continued consumer spending. However, Lupton emphasizes the vulnerability of hand-to-mouth households and a potentially more immediate growth impact. The report also notes that markets are perceived to be underpricing risk, with credit spreads remaining relatively stable despite the potential for a significant energy price shock.
Credit spreads remaining stable, that's unsettling. Is the Fed prepared for this? What's their likely reaction function?
That's the key debate. Kasman suggests patience and a bias towards gradual inflation return, while Lupton leans towards potential easing. Both agree the ECB shouldn't hike in April, but Kasman anticipates some hawkish voices on the FOMC committee. The US government's stated objective of maintaining 10-year bond yields around 4% is threatened, potentially leading to a market rebellion.
A market rebellion? We're really leaning into the drama here. The Bloomberg Surveillance TV segment mentioned BlackRock actively de-risking equity positions. Is everyone bracing for the worst?
BlackRock's move is significant. They're reducing duration, reflecting concerns about the persistence of higher energy prices and limited hedging options. Russ Kosterich's observation that there are no hedges in the current environment is crucial. Traditional hedges like the dollar and treasuries aren't working.
No hedges. Wonderful. Sonal Desai noted that governments will likely respond with substantial fiscal easing measures. Doesn't that just exacerbate the problem?
Worth noting, Desai argues that any significant fiscal response to a prolonged energy shock will inevitably lead to second-round inflationary effects. The bond market is behaving rationally by pricing in the possibility of fiscal easing, a factor often excluded from analyses focused solely on monetary policy. It mirrors the 2021 transitory inflation episode, where fiscal stimulus was the primary driver.
So we're back to fiscal stimulus being the villain. Lupin Raman's report highlights the importance of selective investment within emerging markets, differentiating between net exporters and importers.
Argentina and Brazil are highlighted as potentially attractive destinations, hard currency bonds in Argentina, local currency bonds in Brazil. Pakistan and Egypt are identified as particularly high risk due to limited fiscal space. The impact of the Middle East crisis depends on energy prices, commodity supply, and the duration of the shock.
Duration risk again. Raman also mentioned that emerging market central banks have undergone a shift towards proactively managing inflation and fiscal policy. Is that a sign of stability?
It is.
They've moved away from passively following the Federal Reserve's lead, building institutional credibility. However, the bulk of investment in emerging markets actually comes from domestic investors, providing a more stable foundation than often assumed.
Domestic investors as the key stabilizing force, that's a counterintuitive point. Raman predicts a continued bull market in emerging market debt, contingent on maintaining fundamental value and capturing a greater risk premium.
The key is identifying countries with high real rates and credible central banks. She specifically cites Senegal as an example where market focus on default risks obscures other investment factors. The market's pricing of rate cuts was based on a different macroeconomic context, presenting a trading opportunity.
A lot of nuanced opportunity within emerging markets, but also significant risk if you pick the wrong country. Ultimately, it sounds like we're bracing for a prolonged period of higher energy prices, geopolitical volatility, and potentially recessionary pressures.
We can trace that further. The entire section boils down to this. A sustained energy shock compounded by shifting geopolitical agency towards Iran creates a fundamentally different risk environment where traditional economic rules of thumb and hedges are unreliable, forcing investors to reevaluate asset allocation and prioritize selective risk management.
Jack, if Anthropic's cloud code is already automating tasks previously done by highly paid software engineers, and the S&P 500 Software Industry Index is down 20% in the first quarter of 2026, are we already past the point of potential and squarely in disruption territory?
Two things stand out. The shift isn't just about automation, it's about a fundamental change in the nature of work. We're seeing a transition from creators, the coders, the writers, to managers and editors. The value isn't in producing the raw output, but in the taste and intuition required to refine what the AI generates. That shift, driven by platforms like Cloud Code, is what's driving the market reevaluation, and the S&P 500 data point is an early indicator of that.
Taste on, right up.
So we're outsourcing the actual doing and increasingly just judging. It feels like a very specific and potentially precarious skill set to bet the economy on.
It is, but it's less about replacing human judgment entirely and more about augmenting it. The challenge is that effective AI utilization isn't simply about throwing a prompt at a system. It requires detailed instructions, a deep understanding of the system's limitations, and constant iteration. As Ezra Klein pointed out, these systems aren't fancy autocomplete. They're more like troublesome genies with a developing digital personality that needs to be managed.
A troublesome genie. I'm going to need a whiteboard for this. Let's talk about how this actually happens in commerce. Shopify's position seems interesting, given their focus on small businesses.
Shopify is crucial because they're normalizing AI adoption. The potential lies not just in providing the tools, but in lowering the barriers to entry for small business owners and, critically, shifting public perception beyond job displacement concerns. Botterill predicts a significant impact if they can demonstrably increase income for merchants. A 30% monthly rise would be a game changer. That's not just a tech story, it's a macro story.
A 30% monthly rise. That's aggressive. But if they pull that off, it changes the entire narrative. Okay, so Shopify's democratizing access. What about the businesses already using AI, but not necessarily building it? Anthropic versus OpenAI, for example.
The dynamic between Anthropic and OpenAI is overstated. They're operating in distinct go-to-market motions. OpenAI dominates the consumer space with high mindshare, but Anthropic excels in enterprise, specifically by leveraging code as a gateway into enterprise IT budgets. Anthropic's strategic bet on coding, driving revenue growth through Cloud Code and Cloud Car, is a key differentiator. The gross tonnage revenue model, a PI usage, is enabling that expansion.
Gross tonnage. That's a delightfully bureaucratic term for how much people are paying to use a black box, which leads to the API tax and the inevitable migration to self-hosting.
There's a signal here. The API tax is analogous to the cloud markup of a decade ago, driving companies to explore open source alternatives and in-house training. Adriana Sabato frames it as a potential shift in the industry, and Hugging Face confirms the trend. Pre-training is becoming commoditized, so the focus is shifting towards specialized post-training pipelines and proprietary data.
So everyone's building their own AI. Pinterest, Airbnb, Notion, Cursor, it's a surprisingly widespread trend. But isn't that a lot of duplicated efforts?
It is, but the key isn't just more data, it's experience data, millions of real-world interactions. Intercom's FinApex model, with its 2.8% higher resolution rate and 65% reduction in hallucinations, demonstrates significant performance gains by focusing on customer service-specific post-training. This is where the value lies, in leveraging unique datasets to optimize performance for specific tasks.
2.8% higher resolution rate. That's marketing copyright. Is that actually meaningful?
It's meaningful because it highlights the power of last-mile data, specifically user interaction data at the point of experience. This challenges the bitter lesson in AI, which generally favors larger, more computationally intensive general models. Intercom's Fin model outperforming GPT-5.4, and Opus 4.5 proves that targeted post-training can yield significant results.
So the big labs aren't necessarily building the best AI, they're building the biggest AI. And everyone else is building the most useful AI.
That's a fair simplification. And that utility is driving demand for vertical models, specialized intelligences tailored to specific tasks. Andrej Karpathy anticipates increased speciation in AI, which means we'll see a proliferation of these focused models. This is where durable competitive advantage is shifting, from general-purpose foundation models to the model layer, specifically the ability to acquire and leverage proprietary evaluation datasets.
Evaluation datasets. So it's not about having the best algorithm, it's about having the best testing ground.
It's a telling detail. Paul Adams of Intercom explicitly stated this will be the key differentiator, and Jason Botterill predicts resulting M&A activity and data partnerships. the infrastructure mode for AI is eroding, enabling vertical SaaS companies with sufficient labeled interaction data to bypass reliance on major foundation model providers. Cursor's success with Composer 2 is a prime example.
Okay, so the infrastructure is crumbling, everyone's building their own models, and Shopify is promising impossible income boosts. What about the actual commerce part? I keep getting hung up on how people actually pay for things.
That's where the agentic commerce piece gets tricky. Discoverability of merchants and useful services is a major bottleneck. And while card networks offer existing benefits like fraud protection and consumer familiarity, stablecoins are well-suited for smaller transactions and new, rapidly deployed merchants. The immediate future will be characterized by insufficiency on both sides. Card networks lack instant settlement, while blockchains lack robust risk scoring.
Insufficiency. That's a polite way to say it's a mess. And fraud is a huge issue, right? Especially with AI agents making purchases autonomously.
Fraud risk is inversely proportional to transaction size. Significant for large purchases, less relevant for microtransactions, spending 30 to 40 cents on a data report via X402, for example. This enables a new class of merchants and services operating outside traditional fraud protection frameworks.
So the future of commerce might be a lot of really small purchases. That feels chaotic.
It's a possibility. But the biggest bottleneck isn't payment rails, it's deeply ingrained human social structures and trust expectations. People won't readily outsource decisions to agents, challenging the prevailing focus on technological solutions. Robbie Peterson argues this is a factor overlooked by those prioritizing rail improvements.
Trust. That's a surprisingly low-tech problem. And a surprisingly big one. Honestly, I don't know how this plays out. We're building systems that are fundamentally reshaping the economy, but the biggest obstacle might be whether people actually want to use them. And that feels inherently unpredictable. That matters because if adoption stalls, all the tech in the world doesn't solve anything. We were talking earlier about the limitations of pure financial modeling, how it struggles with real-world constraints. It feels like energy markets are a particularly acute example of that, doesn't it? A system built on assumptions that are constantly shedding.
Something to flag here, and shedding is the right word. Stephen Ehrlich and Sean Murray at Fuse Energy are highlighting a problem that's easy to miss when you're focused on the supply side. $70 billion worth of renewable power wasted in the last 5 years because the grid just couldn't handle it. That's a massive inefficiency, and it's not a technological problem so much as a coordination one.
Coordination or the lack thereof. It's interesting they're framing grid capacity as an L1 problem like a blockchain bottleneck. Demand response seems unconventional for energy, but then again, so is energy.
And that's where the blockchain piece comes in. The energy token isn't about generating more renewables, it's about intelligently managing the demand we already have. Incentivizing consumers to shift their usage, creating a flexible load that can absorb excess capacity. It's a fascinating application of tokenomics to a fundamentally physical constraint.
50% of the token supply earned through customer redemptions, that's a lot of reliance on participation. But the SEC no action letter is a good sign. Still, it's remarkable that even with increasing renewables, gas prices dictate wholesale electricity.
It's a perfect example of thesis and antithesis in action. The growing renewable energy supply clashing with the inelasticity of energy demand, ultimately resolved by the traditional market forces of gas pricing. Fuse Energy's hedging strategies focusing on gas, not just renewables, is a very pragmatic response to that reality. They're acknowledging the system as it is, not as we wish it were.
Pragmatic is one word. They're also running into a wall with prediction markets. Institutional-grade hedging products don't exist for the nuances of temperature, demand, and price. I mean, finding bespoke options, that's a problem.
It speaks to the immaturity of the energy derivatives market. They need options that account for nonlinear relationships, and right now, the liquidity just isn't there. But the fact that even 0.1 megawatts of demand response, about 100 smart homes, can have a noticeable impact on power markets is a huge signal.
100 homes. That's less than I expected.
So here's the picture. It illustrates the leverage available with targeted interventions. Fuse Energy isn't trying to overhaul the entire grid overnight. They're building a network effect, starting small and expanding from there. It's a very clever approach to a systemic problem.
Clever and compliance-focused. But the question I keep coming back to is, what happens when the incentives aren't enough? The energy token addresses congestion, but it doesn't address the fundamental political and infrastructural inertia that creates that congestion in the first place. So, Alex, the Danish election was largely decided by animal welfare and clean drinking water after a geopolitical crisis.
Seriously?
It feels like we're building investment strategies around a SimCity game.
The implication runs deeper, Maya. That's the core of what Jorgit discussed with Niels, the unpredictable nature of narrative dominance in markets, even when objectively larger forces are at play. The focus on domestic issues despite heightened geopolitical tensions surrounding Greenland and the Middle East demonstrates that rational actor models often fall apart.
Rational actors, right? And I gather this throws a wrench into traditional CTA strategies.
It does.
CTAs, as Git points out, primarily focus on shorter-term trends, exploiting returns without fully incorporating the underlying flow of capital. Discretionary traders are much more attuned to these flows, which can be critical, especially when liquidity is tightening.
Liquidity, always the quiet killer. What's the practical implication of ignoring these flows?
The biggest risk is getting caught long illiquid assets ahead of major events like non-farm payrolls. CTAs aren't calibrated for the drift Git's model accounts for, the pendulum swing between over- and underpriced states, so they can be vulnerable when the market shifts rapidly and volume dries up.
A pendulum? Really, Alex? Markets are a pendulum? That feels reductive.
It's a useful framework for understanding the interplay between fundamental value traders and noise traders. Git's Corella model categorizes participants and shows that CTAs, by focusing solely on returns, can actually destabilize markets by exacerbating these swings. But crucially, they represent a small portion of overall volatility.
We're being destabilized by a relatively small group of people who don't realize they're destabilizing us. That's comforting.
Not quite.
It's more that noise traders are the dominant force, with value traders acting as a counterweight. CTAs are simply a third element that, because of their structure, can amplify movements. Incorporating flow analysis could mitigate this, but as Git notes, it introduces its own liquidity risks.
Okay, so you're saying it's a constant balancing act, trying to anticipate irrationality without getting crushed by it?
And fundamentally, Git argues that trying to disprove the efficient market hypothesis is misguided. Markets aren't about knowing the true price, but a blend of price-driven and flow-driven activity. Look at oil 3-year versus 3-month trading reveals vastly different dynamics.
Different dynamics, meaning a CTA strategy focused on short-term oil price movements, might miss a longer-term shift in underlying valuation.
The data tells a story. We need to watch for increasing divergence between short-term CTA positioning and longer-term fundamental signals, particularly in energy and commodities. By April 15th, we may see the first signs of this as Q1 earnings reports begin to surface and reveal shifts in underlying production costs and demand. It will be crucial to assess whether the noise traders are still driving the price or if fundamental values are asserting themselves.
Circling back on everything we've covered today, the sidelined oil, the AI agents, the potential Shopify boom, even the energy token, it feels like we're looking at a system under incredible strain. It's not just one thing, right? It's the convergence of geopolitical fault lines, eroding infrastructure, and a fundamental shift in how value is created and perceived. We talked about traditional modeling failing to account for real-world constraints, and it's becoming clear those constraints are tightening across multiple fronts.
Stepping back, I think the core issue is that we've built this incredibly complex, interconnected network where the signal-to-noise ratio is deteriorating rapidly. The 16 million barrels a day offline isn't an isolated data point. It's a symptom of broader systemic risk. The AI disruption isn't just about automation. It's about the commoditization of output and a race to secure the unique datasets that actually drive utility. It's like the Earth's crust under immense pressure, silently building until a sudden eruption reshapes everything.
And the markets.
They're reacting to narrative, to flow, to whatever provides momentary liquidity, not necessarily fundamental value.
And that's where things get truly unsettling. We had that disagreement about whether consumer spending could insulate us from a recession, and I think the point Alex raised about household vulnerability is critical. Credit spreads are stable now, but that's not a guarantee. It feels like we're operating with no real hedges. The 40% recession probability feels conservative given how many cascading effects are at play.
I agree.
The traditional risk mitigation strategies are proving inadequate. And I think that's because we're seeing a fundamental shift in the source of the risk. It's not about predictable economic cycles anymore. It's about the unpredictable interplay of political events, logistical bottlenecks, and the behaviors of non-rational actors. We discussed the tension between technological solutions, blockchain applications in energy markets, for example, and the political inertia that prevents their widespread adoption. These technologies offer potential, but they're not a panacea.
So what should listeners be watching? Beyond the usual suspects, oil prices, bond yields, I think the Shopify prediction is fascinating. A 30% monthly rise in income for merchants could be a real indicator of AI's impact, if it actually happens. And that divergence Alex mentioned between short-term CTA positioning and longer-term fundamentals in energy by April 15th. That feels like a critical inflection point.
And keep a close eye on emerging market debt. The bull market will continue as long as they can maintain fundamental value, but that's a fragile premise. I'd also suggest paying attention to commodity exporters' shift in focus from terms of trade to equity beta. It's a sign of underlying risk appetite and a willingness to take on more exposure. If I were navigating this environment, I'd say we're approaching submarine depths, relying on multiple sensors, constantly recalibrating our understanding of the currents.
That's a vivid analogy, Alex. Ultimately, it feels like the biggest question mark is whether we're actually seeing a shedding of outdated models and a genuine embrace of new approaches, or just a temporary fluctuation in the pendulum swing. It's a genuine uncertainty.
And that's where the healthy dose of skepticism comes in.
Thanks for joining us today. We'll be back tomorrow to continue unpacking these complexities.